One of my favorite teachings from Elizabeth Mattis Namgyal is, no one is just one way. This means we are all capable of change, but it can also point to our intersectionality. As individuals, we embody many different identities. For example, I'm queer, a woman, white, an activist, a writer, a Buddhist. To pull on another great Buddhist teacher, Zenju Earthlin Manuel, there is multiplicity in oneness. Differences in a single human being and amongst all human beings are all equally representative of what it is to be human. In today's collaboration with Jack Saddleback, a Cree Two-Spirit transgender man, he speaks about the importance of recognizing our own intersectionality as part of creating a better world. Through embracing this multiplicity within himself, as well as being encouraged to volunteer as a child, he connected with what he describes as a need to make it better. Now, as an adult, whether he is working with Indigenous communities or those from a settler background, everything he does is informed by the poignant and necessary question, how can I be a good ancestor? Thank you so much for being on the show.
Well, thanks a bunch for having me. I'm really looking forward to it.
Yeah. I guess to start off, if you could just tell me a bit about your experience growing up and specifically at what point it was that you started to see yourself as an activist. If you do see yourself as an activist, do you see yourself as an activist?
Yeah. Well, for myself, let's start off with kind of my growing up life. And it's a very interesting one because I think it lends itself to that lens about whether or not I do see myself as an activist and whether or not there was a point that I had that light bulb turn on, if you may say. Mm-hmm. So I did grow up and am from the Samson Cree Nation in Musquechese, Alberta. This is halfway between Red Deer and Edmonton. And I was there for the first about 4 years of my life. And then my family and I, due to some of the social issues that were happening on my reserve at Samson in Musquechese, Alberta, required us to relocate to Calgary, Alberta. And that's where I kind of call my hometown. I like to call myself a little cowtown boy because that's kind of where my home base has been for a number of years, ever since I moved most recently here to Saskatoon, Saskatchewan in late 2010 for school. Now, growing up itself was interesting, I'll put it that way, because for the first about 4 or 5 years of my life, I didn't really recognize the unique lens that my own being, my own identity would offer itself to our larger society and world. I myself am I wear it on my sleeve that I'm an out and proud Cree Two-Spirit transgender gay man. And that's taken a long time to get to the stage of recognizing all of those intersecting identities, even though, you know, my introduction when it does come to my identities is super long. You know, I'm not here to showcase how long it is, but, you know, I'm here to showcase the fact that, you know, it's important to be able to look inwards and to explore oneself, because when you explore yourself and the gifts that you are able to offer, you're able to create a better world by understanding where your strengths lie. For me, it did take a while to figure that out. And those first four or five years of my life, you know, I was a very, very happy child. I was allowed to grow up in the gender identity and gender expression that was most comfortable for me. Now, being born female within that particular time, which would be about the 90s, obviously there's still those societal norms for female identified people within our larger society. Mm-hmm. But within my own Cree community, one of the interesting things is the Cree culture teaches within family dynamics that so long as the child is happy, then the community is happy. So I was able to flourish in all of my being. You know, I was able to dress the way I wanted to. I was able to play with the toys I wanted to. You know, I was able to just be me.
That is just such a wonderful radical notion. My goodness, our children should just, express themselves and be happy, and we should be happy with that.
Yeah, and it is interesting to note that yeah, it seems to be a radical notion, but now in all actuality, that's just our way of life, our way of raising our young people is for them to be as comfortable and as happy as they can be. As much as I'd like to say that that's as much as I would really have loved to have said and be saying is that I was able to grow up in that. That's not necessarily the case. I mean, we have our own community, but I think one of the eye-opening things for me was as I was getting older, I started to recognize that my family was encouraging me to be more feminine, to be more like my sisters, to be more on that social norm of being what it quote unquote female is supposed to be like, and that didn't really mesh well with me, and I couldn't understand that for many years, and I didn't have the language to be able to express that to people. The closest that I got at that particular point in time was that I must be a tomboy. Because I'm more masculine, and I feel more masculine. But at the same time, it didn't really sit well with me, I never felt at ease within my own body.
At what point did the term two-spirit come into your life?
Yeah, so the interesting thing about two-spirit is going into that, a lot of my own growing up has been within the indigenous community. And I've always been a part of my community. My family has always been super close with just our cultural ways. And for me, I didn't know about Two-Spirit until I was in grade 10. Nor did anyone within my own community openly talk about Two-Spirit issues or even LGBTQ issues that at least I knew of. It's interesting to note how long it did take for those conversations to happen. And those conversations are happening within our lifetimes. Now, just a little quick going back to what two-spirit means. So the term two-spirit itself was actually coined in Winnipeg in 1990 at the third annual Gay and Lesbian, Native American, and Indian gathering. So that's pretty interesting to note that the birthplace of that was here in Canada and, within the quote-unquote prairie provinces.
Yeah, and also not very long ago, and I think that that's a large misconception about two-spirit. Like, it almost gets romanticized, I think. However, historically, there are records of the Europeans who came here encountering this difference in gender expression that they weren't used to, and naming it in a particular way because of unfamiliarity with traditional dress of Indigenous people and things like that. I, of course, am not telling you anything new. This is for listeners. You know more about this than anybody. But I didn't realize, and it's very interesting, I didn't realize that it was only in 1990 that this term was coined, because I think like a lot of people turn to it as something, like I said, right? Like, it's a very romanticized notion.
Yes, and it's I really enjoy how you had brought up the fact of language and the barrier of language that takes place when looking at the historical acceptance of queer Indigenous people within the Indigenous tribes here prior to contact. And it is true that I think within the modern movement of two-spirit identities or two-spirit awareness that it has been romanticized, but also Indigenous people themselves or ourselves have been romanticized in many ways.
Oh, yeah.
And it's taken as a it's an interesting take that does take place there. But the actual kind of like meaning behind the two-spirit notion is, as those individuals had talked about in 1990, they wanted to showcase the historical acceptance of queer Indigenous people within our tribes. Now, every tribe, every community member, or every community is different from one another. But as oral history has told us. There has always been and always will be two-spirit people within our ceremonies, within our communities. And the term two-spirit itself, there are some interpretations that take place from tribe to tribe, but the overarching aspect is that after talking with a few of the folks, more specifically the amazing Alex Wilson, is that the term two-spirit is the inseparability of one's own gender identity, gender expression, and/or sexual orientation, plus one's own cultural identity. So for me, I'm not just Cree. I'm not just trans. I'm not just gay. All of those things are one within myself, and there are certain ceremonies within my own community that I must take up because of that's there's everyone has a role within their communities, and two-spirit people have certain roles within their own communities. Historically, you can look at people, two-spirit people being medicine people, two-spirit people being adoptive parents, two-spirit people being knowledge keepers, war chiefs, mediators, marriage counselors, and I think that the last one is also interesting to note about the marriage counselors is because there's also the teaching in some tribes that two-spirit people hold both a female spirit and a male spirit within oneself, which kind of transcends the idea of this gender binary, and just kind of makes a unique lens for two-spirit people to have when walking through life. So the whole two-spirit movement is it's not new, if I may say.
No.
It's always been here. It will always be here, and it's just becoming coming into the spotlight nowadays because of the amount of work that's been taking place over the years of our amazing two-spirit elders who are now stepping into those roles of elders, such as Albert MacLeod, such as Marjorie Bukaj, and so many more.
So would you say, would this be sort of a correct assessment that two-spirit was a word, a modern term adopted to encompass the intersectionality of certain individuals within multiple tribes, but within all of those tribes for years and years anyway, prior to contact of Europeans, there would have been some representation of two-spirit, but it probably would have just like it wasn't obviously it wasn't called two-spirit, it was called whatever language, like there was a word in each language for each tribe for someone who fit that kind of role.
Exactly. And that is quite right. And the term two-spirit itself, one of another major factor about the reason why individuals are those particular groups, or that particular group had decided to bring two-spirit forward was because there was no modern language that could showcase that historical acceptance. There was no language within the gay and lesbian, queer, transgender community at that time that would showcase the ways that were of this land before contact.
That's brilliant. So then at what point was it for you that you were saying like in your story of growing up and sense of identity and self-awareness, at what point did you start to touch into this level of engagement that you're in, this sort of whether you call yourself an activist or not, this role that you have now?
So when we had moved to Calgary, like I was saying before, I grew up within my Indigenous communities. Even though we moved to Calgary every weekend or every other weekend, we would try to go back to Musqueam and go partake in ceremonies or just go be with family and keep that connection. When we moved to Calgary, one of those connections that we were also able to make was with within our local what was back then known as the Indian and Métis Friendship Center of Calgary. And my parents would take us there quite often to be with their community members in that area. And I think one of the interesting things about growing up, though, with my parents is that they were very supportive of volunteering. And I remember going to the Indian and Métis Friendship Center of Calgary and volunteering as a young person, going to try and be trained as camp counselors or going in there and just chatting with other youth and letting them know about traditional ceremonies or traditional teachings as well. For me, one of the eye-opening aspects of wanting to make change to create a better world for tomorrow was the work that my mom was doing. My mom, when I was growing up, was actually a social worker and was working at a local reserve there, and unfortunately was one of the go-to people to do apprehensions of children. And at times, I would actually go with my mom to, unfortunately, take these young folks into a different home. So I would be in the car. My mom would go in. She'd go and have a conversation with the family. The young person would come out, and as much as it was a traumatizing experience for this young person, what I would do as another young person, I didn't really put two and two together until years later, but I would sit there and play with them. This other young person was just simply like me. They're just another kid trying to make their own day happy. Trying to live their own true selves every day. And for me, it broke my heart to know and to be aware of the fact that this young person wasn't able to be with their family like I was able to. This young person may be put into a different family dynamic that was foreign to their own upbringing. It could be a young Indigenous person going into a settler household and then not being able to have that connection to their own culture. So for me, I think that's where I started to kind of piece those needs for my own self, that need to make it better. I wouldn't want another young person to have to go through that, and I wouldn't want even for myself growing up within the school system to go through a system that would base my intelligence on the color of my skin. I was put into various educational classrooms, special classrooms, or given a teacher aid just because I was one of the only brown kids in the schools. I grew up in a very affluent neighborhood in Calgary, and it's as the youngest of six kids in a neighborhood where typically they only have maybe one to three kids in their own households. We were always seen as being those quote unquote Indians. They're rambunctious. They're running everywhere. They're always out on their bikes. When in all actuality, we were just being kids. Our parents trusted us. We all looked after one another. We were always having a good time in a safe environment, and we always tried to create that for one another. And that's what I felt as growing up. I wanted to create that for those young people that I saw throughout those years, during my mom's work and during my own volunteering. So growing up, it came into my attention that I went through some tough times as a young person, facing those systemic barriers, facing transphobic attitudes or trans negative attitudes towards me as a genderqueer kid, or an androgynous kid going through the school system, having those also homo negative feelings projected upon me from my own peers, from my own teachers, from just the systems that I had to navigate on a daily basis. It was always a difficult time, and I always thought, like, why me? Why me? And then I think there came a point in my own life where I got super depressed, very isolated because of those systems, and always having to ask myself about why me, and always having to validate my own identity on a day-to-day basis after years of being asked, are you a boy or a girl? Are you gay or straight? Like, why can't a young person just be? And that's that. So after all those years, that isolation and that depression really came at a forefront when I was about 14 or 15. And I unfortunately got to a situation where I felt my only solution was to try and commit suicide. So that particular time in my life was very hard. But after some hard inward looking at, like, what is that core aspect that's really gnawing away at me, I was able to go back into my ceremonies and look at that, try and heal through that. I was able to go into our own mental health systems and heal through that way as well, through conventional therapy. And it occurred to me, like, I don't want other kids to have to go through this. I don't want other kids to have to traverse this education system in a very negative way. I don't want other young people to have to not grow up with their own cultural ceremonies. And it kind of spiraled from there, you know. I wanted to make it queer friendly, so I started going to youth groups. I wanted to make it better for our Indigenous community, so I started talking up within not only those queer youth groups, but also within my own school systems, letting them know, like, hey, you know, maybe you shouldn't say that the Red River Rebellion was a rebellion. You know, maybe you should say that the Red River Rebellion was a resistance. It was a resistance against this ridiculous system that was coming through. Yeah, so it was just those small things that I started talking about, and then the story itself just kind of writes this longer path and in different ways. You know, as much as it might have been within person-to-person contact about, you know, talking about the issues that are taking place, and you know, you can call me an activist, and in that matter, you know, if I'm sitting down having a coffee with someone, you can also be an activist through just simple visibility of being an out and proud Cree, Two-Spirit, transgender gay man. You can also call me an activist in the political life that I've have since kind of fell into in some weird way. But
It's been pulled
yeah.
into
Yeah, it's the universe works in strange ways. The creator puts you where you're needed to be, and yeah. So for me,
that's great.
activism has been a long time coming, and it has always, I think, always been a part of my life because of the great family that I have, the great support network that I've been able to grow up with, and the great cultural background that teaches the seven generation teachings of making it better for those next seven generations.
So that I'm so glad that you just said that. So I whenever I do this, I really like to bring parallels because I don't think that wisdom is ever siloed or uniquely belonging to any particular group. It's a very nice thing. It's like wisdom just comes in lots of different packages. So in Buddhism, there's the concept of rebirth and karma, and they are pretty much there in hand in hand. Very complicated to go into any great length to explain right now, but having an understanding of both is considered essential for us to understand the role that we play and the effect that our choices have, basically. It's to say we're all interconnected and therefore we have responsibilities to one another. So there's that self-awareness, but then there's also that awareness of where we fit within everything around us and everyone around us. And when you're thinking about rebirth, it's about in this lifetime and future lifetimes. So when we act with that sort of awareness in our mind, we bring to our actions awareness of the consequences that they'll have and how that'll fan out. So it's not just if I do this one thing, this will be the one result. It's if I do this one thing, there will be many results over time affecting many people and many places and many lifetimes, which to me sounds really similar to the seven generations thing. I watched your video from the We Day Saskatchewan in 2016, and that's where you talk about the seven generations. Could you riff on that for a bit and talk a bit about how it works for you as a practice and how it informs your choices?
So we'll talk first off about the actual seven generations teachings, just for folks who may not be aware of that. The seven generations teachings teaches that to recognize the decisions or the actions that the seven generations, our ancestors before us, have made to make it better for us today. Think about those seven generations ago when they were signing those treaties. You know, they were thinking about my own well-being. They were thinking about your own well-being as well. They didn't know who we would be. They didn't know how we would grow up. They didn't know anything about us. But what they did know was that they had a love for each individual that was going to be coming after them. And they had that responsibility to make wise choices, to make choices in the best interest that would make it better for those generations coming after us. Now, thinking about those seven generations before us, we right now have to think about the seven generations coming after us. We must think and make decisions and take up causes that are going to make it better for them coming after. We have to think about those little ones. We have to think about those tiny Jacks that are going to be growing up in the generations behind us. And for me, like that's what informs my decisions when I wake up in the morning. When I'm around a decision table. When I'm thinking about walking down the street and helping someone out, I think about and really ask myself, how can I be a good ancestor?
Oh, that's a really good question. I really like that. I find questions are very powerful. Holding questions. That sounds like such a good question to hold. How can I be a good ancestor?
Yeah, we all have a shared history. And those individuals long before you and I, who may have been signing those treaties, who may have been immigrating here from other lands, they thought about our well-being. And we have to think about the well-being of those coming after us. And it's important that we take on that responsibility, as scary as it may be. Don't worry, you don't have to solve all the world's problems, but you do have to try to make it better for someone else.
With the scary as it may be comment, I'm gonna touch in on mental health here, which it can be a bit buzzwordy these days, but I really love how you frame it. Specifically, you say not everyone has a mental illness, but everyone has a mental health. And I think when you're talking about the scariness of sort of the responsibility, we look at the world and it's very easy to become overwhelmed, to fall into despair and depression. We look at the state of the world, which is also, I think the seven generation thing is really good. It's important to look back and look at things. There was a time when it seemed impossible that apartheid in Africa would end, and yet there's no more apartheid in South Africa. So there is hope, there is change, there is moving forward in some way. So how's your own experience with mental health affect your understanding of how you can support people and how you can support yourself in the work that you do?
Well, I think my own experience with mental health is varied throughout the years. Coming back to my own upbringing and that particular point in my own lifetime of the suicidal ideations and the suicide attempt, I think within that frame of mind, I didn't see myself growing up. I didn't see myself going forward. And that's a scary place to be in. That can be a difficult place to get out of. And now when I think about nowadays and how I was able to overcome that through the tips and the tricks that my own culture as well as therapy have taught me, it's lent itself very well to just having that self-care. If there's one thing that I can really hammer in there is just self-care is of the utmost importance, because we cannot help those seven generations going forward if we can't help ourselves at the same time. We have to be kind to our bodies, we have to be kind to our minds, and we have to be kind to our own emotional well-being. And take the time out to kind of love yourself and to treat yourself at times. I know that I had definitely gotten caught up in the work, in the hubbub. We hear so often of burnout within the activist community. And I feel that's because we're so focused on the larger overarching goal of creating a better tomorrow that at times we have to take a step back and see our own reality of, maybe today I just need to unplug and take a step back, or maybe I don't need to go on that work trip and just stay in for the weekend. Really listen to myself. And that was a hard thing to do, was to listen to my own body and to also be okay to say not right now, or some people say no, I like to go with the not right now, maybe at a later date we'll be able to look into that, but not right now. So it's about looking at your own mental health, because it is true we all have a mental health. Not all of us may have a mental illness, but we all have a mental health. And to recognize that and to treat it just like we are treating our bodies well, we have to treat our mind well as well.
I want to circle back. You were talking about questioning the things that you learned, the time when you started to sort of stand up and take a role of inserting yourself to be an agent for change, which I always find interesting how people get to that place where you stop doing the why me and start being like, why anyone? Why should anyone have to suffer like this? And I was it just struck me because it was making me think about when I learned about Louis Riel in school specifically, and I came home and it was all very casual. It was kind of off the cuff. Oh yeah, he was he fought to protect Métis land, and ultimately he was killed, and here's a letter. And I didn't really understand why he was killed. And when I told my mom about learning this, this is when she told me that we were actually related to Louis Riel distantly in my family tree. And so I got fascinated and I started to research it. And I found it really interesting how, in talking to my mom, she said, when I was learning about this, he was taught as being, like, we were told he was a traitor. So there's a shift, My mom would have learned about Louis Riel in the 60s, the 50s and the 60s, and then I was learning about Louis Riel in the 90s. So there's like a slight shift, and it is slow. And I think that for a lot of people, there's like this sense of urgency, like we want to see the change now. We want to see it like immediately. So what sort of advice can you give to people who have that sense of urgency, who are really like pushing and driving and like, I want to see it, like, why can't it just be better already?
One of the interesting things that I've learned over the years when doing diversity work, when doing inclusion work, when doing equity work, is that our language at times can be so far ahead within certain communities, and it's fantastic to see. But then, let's say I find myself in smaller towns, and I recognize that we need to meet people where they're at. At times, we are having to walk this journey with people and show them each step of the way of like this is the reason why the resistance happened was because there was racism going on, there was discrimination going on, there was systemic discrimination going on, there was encroachment of land, there was abolishment of identity going on, and this is the reason why. Let's say today there's that intergenerational trauma that's happening for folks. And then you also have to talk about intergenerational trauma. And you have to meet people and walk them through that and utilize the language that they already understand. When coming to the LGBTQ side of things, I could already jump to, let's say, asexual, the term asexual, which nowadays, it's becoming much more aware of, like, what does that mean, right? But let's say I go up north, or I go to the far east of Canada, and someone has never heard of asexual. Okay, well, let's find out what other terms and let's work from there. So it's all about meeting people where they're at, and I always believe in the goodness of the human being. They may not understand what's going on. They may not understand why the current struggles are happening. But I think at the core of things, they want to see something better as well. But you need to meet people where they're at and utilize language that they can understand. And we're all on this journey together. This is a shared history. So as a person who's able to do these teachings, not just myself, I'm talking to about everyone. As ask yourselves, as a person who can teach these languages, who can teach these ideas and these concepts, take it upon yourself to pass that information on while meeting people where they're at and walking with them. It's a tough road sometimes because it's not out of ignorance or well, at times, sorry, it is about ignorance, but it's not out of malice that people most times it's not out of malice that people don't understand things or can't understand things. It's just simply out of ignorance and not knowing what things are. Like I said at in our conversation earlier was that I didn't have a language for the internal struggles or conflicts that I was going through as a young androgynous genderqueer kid. I didn't know that I was actually a trans man because I didn't know the language. I didn't have the representation out there in the greater society for me to see myself reflected. So, yeah, it's
Yeah, I
all
know
about
how
the
that
work.
feels. I remember the
Yeah.
first time I heard the term bisexual, I was like mind blown. I'm like, what? There's a gray area? Whoa.
Whoa.
It is. It's actually, I guess that's the thing, is it's sort of reflecting on yourself and your own experience and going, well, when did I learn these words? When did I get introduced to the intersectionality within me with words I could use for that, and then start to turn that outward in ways that I could then relate to other people and their intersectionality, even if it's an experience that's different from my own. So my last question is, what support or guidance would you like to offer to listeners? Specific things that you would turn to or give as resources, basically, for anyone who wants to be an effective agent for change in the world.
I think what has been able to sustain me over the years has been just my connection to self. And I feel like this is a human trait where we sometimes lose that connection, and that is A-okay. There have been points in my life where I've just felt like an empty husk, but it was because I wasn't taking care of myself, mind, body, spirit, and soul. It's all about looking after those four things and keeping them in balance and finding out where to really take the time to look after oneself. And for me, when it comes to doing that, a lot of the resources that I lean heavily on are my support network. One of them being, my fantastic husband, who I met just 5 years ago, and look at where I am 5 years after meeting this fantastic person who I've just been able to be very open and honest with, and has been able to give me some guidance. Speaking about guidance, like my own community as well, it's important that I recognize that I wouldn't be where I am today if it wasn't for the love and support and that guidance that they have been able to help me with over the years. So that sustainability has just been through the energy of those around me and through that thought of why I'm really doing this and coming back to that goal or that value, that principle of why am I getting up in the morning and going to places that I know I may not be welcome, that I know are have been set up in a way to try and abolish my identity? Why am I doing this? It's because I want to see it better for the younger ones to come, for the little ones to come. I want to see it better for a little Jack. I don't want someone to have to grow up in the hostile and isolating environment that I had to grow up in. I want to make it better for them. And for me, when I reflect back on that particular value, that principle, that sustains me along with that support network. And I always come back to the question that keeps that energy going of how can I be a good ancestor.
Fantastic. Thank you so much.
Yeah, no problem. Thank you so much for having me on. I really appreciate it.
Jack Saddleback is an advocate, role model, and speaker. He is available for keynotes and workshops. You can connect with Jack and find out more about his work at jacksaddleback.com. To find out more about my work in the world, to get in touch with me, or to become a patron, visit CaitlinSCHatch.com. The link is in the show description. This episode of Everything is Workable was made possible through the patronage of Gretchen Wagner, Julian and Shannon Hatch, Winita Budgen, and Margaret Prescott. Thank you to Tejai Moore of Moore Music for the original theme song.